Hey there. Welcome back to another episode of Foot Traffic. I am so excited to share this episode with you. This, I get to interview Mark Randolph. He's actually the co-founder and the first CEO of Netflix. It was such an incredible conversation. He really gave me I kind of asked some questions that I just kind of assume you think you know the answer to. And I will tell you, I was wrong quite a bit. Now, a lot of people know him as the co-founder of Netflix, but he has really done, I think he said this was like business number 5. He's been an entrepreneur for more than 4 decades. He sold a company to Google in 2019 for $2.6 billion. Okay. He is just an amazing person talking to in this early stage of company. That's who he's passionate about teaching. He is really looking to help these startups find that repeatable, scalable business. And this is a perfect episode for the listeners of Foot Traffic. So enjoy. I hope you like this episode as much as I loved getting to interview him. Growing your business doesn't have to be difficult. It's all about mastering a few key techniques, systems, and mindset. Welcome to Foot Traffic. With over 1 million downloads, it's the go-to marketing podcast dedicated to helping you grow your small business. I'm your host, Stacey Tuschel. I've been an entrepreneur for over 15 years, and I own multiple 7-figure businesses. Together, you and I are going to get you more customers in the door, more profit in your pocket, and more happiness in your home. Let's transform your business starting right now. Hi, Mark. Welcome to Foot Traffic.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
So excited to have you. Now, you're really well known for being one of the co-founders of Netflix and the first CEO, but you've had quite the entrepreneurial journey. And I'd love to hear what that looked like, how it got started.
Yeah, I guess I was the ripe old age of 38 when I started Netflix. So I guess that's, it's like dog years. You know, I guess I was actually 140. I've been doing this, I was going to say my whole life, and I guess that is in some ways true. I've been an entrepreneur for, 40 years or so, something like that. Mm-hmm. And Netflix was in fact number six of terms of companies that I either started or played a big role in starting. But, it goes back even further than that. Some of my earliest jobs were ones where I was doing something which was either hard or something where I had to iterate or something where there wasn't an obvious solution. And for some reason, I've always been really drawn to that. I find myself always seeing a frustration and then going, oh, there's got to be a better way to do this. Mm-hmm. Or if someone's saying, oh, that's not going to work, I go, well, maybe we can figure out a way to make this work. Mm-hmm. So, I've been an entrepreneur a long time. And we started off in direct marketing realm I did 2 magazines, did 2 mail order companies. And then, of course, when the internet came along, all bets were off. And then it got really interesting.
I love it. And now you have a new book out, That Will Never Work. What inspired you to write it? Like, what is the behind the scenes of this book?
There was a couple reasons I wrote the book. I wrote the book, 16 years after I left Netflix. So this was not me all of a sudden going, okay, I have to tell this story. It took a while to really be able to look back honestly and say, what really was my role in this? What did I do well? What did I not do well? What succeeded in spite of me? Mm-hmm. But the real driving reason for writing the book was twofold. One, I wanted people to see what really goes into starting a company. There is in this glorification of the entrepreneur as someone who wakes up one morning with this brilliant insight and boom, all of a sudden you have this fully formed company. And in fact, that is completely not the case. Mm-hmm. It's uncertain. It's stumbling. It goes in strange directions. It's not one person's genius vision. It's a team of people, each contributing some different insights, some different way of approaching a problem. And I wanted people to see that. Most importantly, I wanted to see that it is not all success. That in fact, there's some real struggles that went on that, not just in the business, but also personally. Yeah. But the other reason is that I kind of had this insight shortly before writing the book, which is this realization that all of these tips and tricks and secrets that I'd learned over 40 years as an entrepreneur were the exact same tips and tricks and secrets that anybody who has an idea could use to make that idea real, regardless of whether it's a business or not. Certainly, regardless of whether it's an internet business, these are things that anybody could use. And I wanted to share all that I'd learned and show not just trite observations, like just start, but I mean, but literally say, here's how. Here's how to take the idea. Here's things you actively can do to try and make these things real.
Yeah. As a visionary, I think we're always, we think every idea we have is going to be a great idea. When you were starting these companies, did you have this gut instinct of this is going to be big, this is going to work? And were there ever companies that you had, like thoughts and ideas you had that they did not do well?
I actually had a different view. I think all the ideas that I have are bad ideas. And I'm completely comfortable about that. And in fact, I think it's probably one of the most important insights for everybody is that stop looking for a good idea. There is no such thing as a good idea, because searching for a good idea means you never start. You're always looking for some external validation. You're always standing there trying to see around the corner for some assurance that this path you're choosing is actually going to lead somewhere. And what I have learned from all of my own companies, from all the people I've mentored, from all the investments I made, is that there's no such thing as a good idea. And in fact, the role of anybody who wants to do something is you've got to take that bad idea and just say, I'm going to figure out why it's a bad idea, because that is the process. By colliding that bad idea with reality in some way, you start that path of iteration, of testing, of exploration, which if you're lucky and if you're persistent, eventually may actually lead you to something which does work. But it won't happen if you're stuck on the good idea. The worst thing, the other worst thing that people can do is they fall in love with their idea. Their idea is so good. Oh, then a couple of things happen. One is they say, I'm a good idea and I'm in search of a problem. I love this idea. I got to find someone who needs this thing, which is ridiculous. But the other one is you keep it nice and safe and warm in your head where it's going to be nurtured and it can grow in this imaginary universe into this huge success. You see it. And then of course, you want to go and start it and you go, oh my gosh, but it's huge. I guess I need to quit my job. I need to raise money. I need my computer science degree. I need my co-founder. And if you say, no, no, stop. I'm not going to nurture this thing. I'm going to get it out of my head right now. I'm going to figure out some way in the next hour that I can collide this with reality. Boy, there's a long, you've got off on a tear there.
So good. So the book That Will Never Work, is that something you've been told over and over? Is it something like you have had to say to people? Where did that title come from?
So it technically came from my wife, who in her most supportive fashion usually has that to say about all the ideas I come down in the morning and pitch to her.
Yes.
But I think everyone has that experience. So it really is trying to recognize that that is the helpful advice that you get when you go to someone and say, I think I have a really interesting idea here. That'll never work. You know, I heard it certainly with Netflix. I heard it from investors. I heard it from employees I was trying to convince to join. I heard it from my wife, heard it from my family. And it's now become this thing that I just recognize is just one of those little signposts you pass on the way. Check. Because the reality is, my other favorite expression besides that'll never work is that nobody knows anything. No one has any clue in advance whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. So when they tell you that'll never work, I'm going to listen. I'm going to hear what your objections are, but I'm certainly not going to take those as some reason that I'm not going to get started.
Yeah, I love it. You're right. Nobody really knows. So is there something that you were told will never work that still sticks out in your mind today of like, I was right and here's what happened? Like, what is a story you can remember?
No, it's not that will never work is this motivational force for me. It's not like, oh, I'm going to show them. And then, of course, you can look back and say, okay, occasionally there were a few things that I thought would work. It really is more of this word for me that I've learned, that I've trained myself to ignore. And you do have to train yourself to ignore it. It's human nature for us not to want to make asses of ourselves.
Yeah.
It's human nature not to want to try things that aren't going to work. I mean, anyone who's learned a foreign language knows that you have to go through that phase of sounding like you're a five-year-old. And you've got to be willing to walk in that coffee shop as a 40-year-old adult and have stuff come out of your mouth that is gibberish. That's the process. And ideas are no different. You have to get comfortable with the fact that that'll never work, but I'm going to do it anyway. And you do it in a small way. You order coffee. You don't get the job as a simultaneous translator at the United Nations.
Yeah.
So no, there's no one that I said, there you go. And I gloat about that. Most of my ideas are bad ones. Almost all my ideas are bad ones. What I'm proud of is not that I'm some kind of genius ideator. It's that I have, A, the persistence to keep trying one bad idea after another. But the skill that I've learned is I'm really good now at taking an idea and figuring out a way to quickly and cheaply and easily collide it with reality. That's the skill. So we shouldn't get hung up on the idea. Ideas don't count for anything.
I love it. Now, you have been innovative after, you know, business after business after business. How do you stay innovative? How do you keep coming up with that next best thing for you?
I'll give you the trite way to say it is that basically I've learned to not ever fall in love with my idea. Mm-hmm. What I learned to fall in love with is the problem. Because the problem, that does not go away. The problem, the more ideas you have that don't work, if you're doing good experiments, you're making your problem more nuanced, more sophisticated. You learn about who has the problem, why do they have the problem, when, what's been tried. That is fascinating. And in some ways, it's like doing a, doing a crossword puzzle where you know it's solvable. That would be a cruel twist of fate to publish in a newspaper, one that's unsolvable, but you, for the life of you, can't see your way through it. And so you go off and have a cup of coffee, or you come back the next day, and then all of a sudden something happens. And that's the thrill. So that's what keeps you going is this is such an interesting problem. Because I've been doing it a long time. I came of age as an entrepreneur before it was this glorified thing, before people were on TV and there was movies and Shark Tanks. And I just did it because I loved solving problems. And that's never gone away from me. And what I'm trying to do with the book, with the podcast, with my speaking is tell people, do this for the right reasons. It's like, you know, being an actress. If you're moving to Hollywood to be an actress because you want to be rich and famous, well, I hate to break it to you. It's extremely unlikely. And the same token goes if you're trying to be an entrepreneur for those reasons. Whereas if your motivations are because you love solving problems, you love coming to work each day and doing something different, you love sitting around the table with really smart people solving really interesting problems, you will love your job.
So good. Now, a lot of small business owners, we refer to our business as our baby. It becomes something that is like we cannot part with. And as somebody that has sold businesses in the past, what do you tell that person who just cannot even fathom doing something like that because it is their baby? It is what they're building.
The problem becomes not when you treat your baby as your baby. Your baby is helpless. Your baby needs you. It looks up at you with those eyes. You'll do anything. Maybe when your baby is six, you still go, that's my baby. Mm-hmm. Maybe when they're in high school, they're your baby. What's pathetic is when you're treating your 37-year-old son as your baby, because quite frankly, you're not doing a service by protecting your 37-year-old son from any of life's challenges. And that's the problem, is that what happens is, ironically, if you're lucky, your baby grows up and your baby begins to get some chops and begins to really stand on its own two feet. And there becomes this moment of reckoning when you say, what's best for my baby? And quite frankly, it may not be you.
I just have to pause. And it may not be you. Wow. Okay. So good.
There is this realization. Listen, and I'm speaking from, I'm going to say from experience.
Yeah.
I was the first CEO of Netflix. I'm not the current CEO of Netflix. Mm-hmm. Netflix has gone on to phenomenal success, not by my hands. And there was a moment when, you know, Reed Hastings, who is my co-founder, mm-hmm. who was not part of the company at the very beginning, poked his head into my office one evening on his way home from his other job, and, you know, and said, we got to talk. And he was concerned about my leadership. And I was scared because I thought for a minute he was going to fire me. Mm. He had more stock than I did, but he was really saying something different. He was going, I should join the company full time and we should run the company together. And it was a really, really interesting moment, because that's where I realized that this dream that I had, this dream of starting and running the successful business, was really, in fact, two different dreams. There was the dream of the being successful business, and then there was the dream of me running it. And what really is really making me confront was that if I wanted one dream to come true, maybe I had to step away from the other. And more importantly, the dream of the big successful company wasn't just my dream anymore. I mean, the other employees had that same dream. My investors had that same dream. Maybe even my customers had the same dream. Mm-hmm. And I realized that, in fact, Reed in this case was right. It was hard to argue with the fact that the company would be stronger with two of us running together. And it was certainly not an easy thing to do. But if I look back, probably one of the best decisions I think I ever made at Netflix or otherwise.
Yeah.
Because those years of Reed and I running it together were in many ways the renaissance at Netflix. And certainly you look at what he's done since I've left with Netflix. And listen, all of us, if we're lucky, have to confront that. And if you look at some of the big successful businesses of now, the number of times that it was the person who started it and who struggled with finding definition and reaching the repeatable, scalable business model and growing it from 10 to 100 to 1,000 to 10,000 is the same person. I probably count it in one hand.
Right.
More often it's me coaching. I do a lot of mentoring now, and I have a number of times coached people through that realization that maybe I'm not the best person to bring this business to the next level.
Yeah. And I'm hearing from you over and over in different ways is really just getting rid of that ego. You don't get to, you know, fight to show that somebody's right and all of those things. It's just, it kind of keeps coming back to having to make hard decisions for really what's best for the company versus being self-centered and really thinking, well, how do I get ahead or how do I go to that next level personally?
I'm not going to make it a value judgment thing, because it's perfectly appropriate to have a family business. Mm-hmm. It's perfectly appropriate to say, I want to have a small lifestyle business, or it's perfectly appropriate to say, this is about me. What's important is to make sure those values and that assumptions is shared. What's not appropriate is to raise money from a venture capitalist, for example, where the explicit condition is not we're doing this because we like you. The explicit condition is we're giving you the money because we expect it back times 10. And if that's the case, it's not appropriate to say, oh, no, wait, this is not about me ever making money for you. This is about me. Mm-hmm. That's where you get into trouble. And certainly from the very big business, when I've recruited someone to join me, I've, whether explicitly or not, made it clear that we're going to do the right things for the business here, especially then I operate in a different realm. So again, I'm not saying there's certainly circumstances that are different, but for me, you're right. It's not that I don't have an ego. I just that I've recognized it's fine that I'll put it a different way. If I have 2 seconds to do
it, go for it,
which is that I consider myself unbelievably lucky, but not necessarily because of the companies, but because I learned something about myself a long time ago, which is I learned what I like doing and I learned what I'm good at. And the lucky thing is they're both the same, which is early stage companies. I love it. Mm-hmm. I love solving those kind of problems. I love when you're not sure what the right model is. It's that discovery is so fascinating to me. And here, the modesty alert, I'm actually really good at it. I just have some of these natural skills that go into that type of environment. And mm-hmm. how lucky is that that I get to do this every day? But look what happened with Netflix. You know, even after a read came in, maybe 6-7 years later, we had our IPO. We were crushing it. We were hiring these people who were blowing my mind how capable they were. And yes, I still thought of this company as my baby.
Yeah.
But I realized Netflix wasn't a startup anymore. And the reality was I didn't like what I was doing in the same way. And more importantly, I wasn't very good at it. And the insight wasn't, oh, it's all about the ego, get out of the way, let Netflix succeed, although that was part of it. The reality is, what does success mean? Success means getting to do things you like and you're right. good at. And that's not this.
Yeah.
That's what I have gotten a chance to do for the remaining, whatever it is, 17 years, which is I get to work with other early stage companies, helping them do this. I get to mentor people on the podcast. I get to do it on the book.
I love it.
I'm the luckiest guy in the world.
What are some, I guess, key messages with the podcast or the book for those early stage startups? What are some things they should be aware of or things that you assess when you first work with them?
Well, what's fascinating, especially with the podcast, is I worried I'm going to run out of things to talk about, but wow, was I wrong about that? It turns out that, of course, the challenges that faced any business owner, everyone who's trying to, whether it's take an idea and make it real or take a side hustle and make it your primary business, or even have an existing business and make it bigger, there's a million of those things. And in my world, whether it's technology or whether it's marketing or whether it's sales or finance, yes, you get those. But what's interesting is the other things people struggle with, conflicts with their co-founders, how to find balance with their home life and their work life. Mm-hmm. It's amazing all the different things we get to dissect. And the valuable part for me, the reason I do it the way I do it, where I'm mentoring real people as opposed to celebrity entrepreneurs,
yeah,
was that I didn't want to be the person who came on someone's like your show and said things like, it's all about focus or mm-hmm. it's all about starting, which yes, it's true. But everyone goes, yeah, but huh? I wanted to actually show, how do you do that? How do you walk somebody through starting? I can say finding a quick, cheap, and easy way to validate your idea. How? Let's play with that.
Yeah.
And it's a chance to watch. These are real sessions, almost identical to what would happen if I took any of your listeners and sat down with them in my house for an hour and said, let's try and break this down a little bit.
So good. How long do you consider a business to be a startup? Is it length in business? Is it like sophistication of their team, revenues? What are you looking at?
I guess I would adhere to what I consider the standard definition, which is that a startup is a group of people in search of a repeatable, scalable business model. So by that definition, once you found the repeatable, scalable business model, you're in some ways calling off your search.
Okay.
And now you're starting to learn how to repeat it and scale it. That definition doesn't work very well anymore because it's that whole repeatable part. Because a lot of times the repeatable is by forces beyond your control. And we have certainly seen what happens to repeatable business models in the last 18 months. When all of the assumptions that you had made about, I can see the next 8 quarters because I can keep on doing what I'm doing, but a bit more of it, everything's changed.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, a startup is purely a mindset. It basically says, I'm going to spend less time worrying about what the future is going to hold and more time preparing myself to take advantage of whatever the circumstances are. Mm. It's this constant reevaluation of the world and preparing yourself to be willing to pivot, shift, change,
right,
to adapt to that.
So some established businesses could have gone backwards to startup phase with the pandemic, you're saying?
I'm saying that the ones that weren't able to do that have been crushed.
Yeah.
The ones that have are the ones that have been able to hold on. And the speed at which they can do that makes all the difference. And you certainly saw it, for example, with restaurants, which all of a sudden recognize this, but they all did it in different speeds based on, in my opinion, a lot of factors, but partly their mindset. Some were filled with people who said, I have always done something this way. And they're deer in the headlights. Right. Others were filled with people who go, oh, okay, well, maybe we could do this, and are willing to try and experiment and see what happens. And that's thinking like a startup. And that's something that I would say you should never lose. I think one of the big defining differences between a company like Netflix and others, or I'll put Amazon in the same category, is that they're always willing to walk away from the present in search of the future. They recognize that when the world turns, the customer could care less about the fact that, oh, I've got these really high-priced distributors I have to keep happy, or what about my key sale? Yes, those are real problems, but that's not the customer's problem. And if you don't have the courage and the discipline to say, I've got to totally disrupt my business model to take advantage of what this new reality is, I guarantee one of my little startups will be happy to do it for you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Mark, so good. Okay, where can people find the podcast, the book? Fill us in. This has been phenomenal.
Yeah, so the book is called That Will Never Work, The Birth of Netflix and the Amazing Life of an Idea, and it can be found hopefully any place that you would find a book these days. The podcast, also called That Will Never Work, also any place you would find podcasts. But really, for all things Mark Randolph, there's a website. For those of you who are younger, there are these things called websites. It's markrandolph.com, Mark with a C, Randolph with a PH. And there you can, if you don't have the patience for a 30-minute podcast or a 300-page book, I'll serve it up to you in essays, in Instagram posts, in Twitter tweets. And one size does not fit all, but I hopefully got you covered.
Amazing. Mark, thank you so much for being here. Everybody, go grab a copy of his amazing book. Definitely subscribe to his podcast. We just appreciate your time and just being here and being so open and honest with us today.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure, and really good luck to everybody. I know these are challenging times, but hang in there.
If you're loving the Foot Traffic podcast, I want to invite you to hang out with me for 5 days. Yes, join us in our next live 5-day bootcamp, where we will be discussing 10 free or low-cost ways to drive more traffic, and you will be blown away by the content that we cover inside. Go to drivemoretraffic.net to get signed up, and let's get you more visible.